Welcome to the South Carolina Lead, a podcast that breaks down state political news for you and provides insight on legislative happenings under the Statehouse Dome in Columbia. Hello, I'm your host, Gavin Jackson, and this episode is for the week of November 15th, 2018. And just a heads up, we're taking off next week, the week of Thanksgiving off, so gobble gobble. This week, we're taking another look at how the midterms played out in South Carolina, the constitutional officers who were reelected, the state superintendent referendum that failed, and the state's outdated voting machines that are on the fritz. The Lead is a podcast where we go behind the headlines with the reporters who wrote the stories affecting you. Every Tuesday, we give you a roundup of news, insight into the week's biggest stories, campaign trail intrigue, and a chaser of trivia. You can listen to all four sections of this podcast while you change a flat tire after a weekend in New Orleans. I apologize, that's why we were late this week, y'all. Or while you're hiding in the bathroom at your aunt's house during Thanksgiving while you wonder who's going to start talking politics first, your crazy right-wing uncle or your crazy left-wing aunt. Oh, please God, no. Who wants more stuffing? Now for our brief quorum call. Quorum call is a term to see if there's a majority present, but here on the South Carolina Lead, we know a majority of the time that you're not always current with the news. So here's a quick recap of several top stories you should know about. Number one, listeners may remember this story from the aftermath of Hurricane Florence. The Associated Press reported that the two women who drowned in the back of a locked police van did so because the deputies driving them lacked a key or bolt cutters to get them out. The deputies who drove around barricades and a manned checkpoint also ignored the safer route they had been given to avoid floodwaters from Hurricane Florence, and they bear plenty of responsibility for the deaths of Wendy Newton and Nicolette Green, said Tommy Britton, who's the lawyer for Newton's family. The two were being transported for a commitment to a mental hospital, and the deputies have been fired and a criminal investigation into their actions is coming to an end. A boondoggle update. Number two, the state newspaper reported SCENG ignored numerous warning signs before walking away from a failed $9 billion nuclear expansion project at VC Summer. This according to an industry consultant who told the South Carolina Public Service Commission on Monday. Scott Rubin, who is an independent utility consultant and attorney from Pennsylvania, testified on behalf of AARP of South Carolina and argued there were numerous signs in 2013 and early 2014 that the project should have been canceled. Among those was a 14-page summary outlining problems with work by the project's contractors. This was written by SCNG's then chief executive officer in May 2014. Number three, the Greenville News reported sadly that Liz Patterson, a former U.S. representative for South Carolina's 4th Congressional District, died Saturday after an extended illness. She was 78. She served the district for three terms from 1987 to 1993 and was the last woman to represent South Carolina in Congress. The district includes Spartanburg and Greenville counties. And number four, MOX update. The Aiken Standard reported that roughly one-third of the mixed oxide fuel fabrication facility workforce will be let go by early next year. That's about 500 CB&I Project Services Group employees who will be laid off as of January 7, 2019. This according to a November spreadsheet published by SC Works, which is a statewide employment agency and initiative. MOX is located at the Savannah River site and was designed to transfer weapons-grade plutonium into fuel for commercial nuclear reactors. On October 10th, the National Nuclear Security Administration, which is part of the U.S. Department of Energy, terminated MOX, the MOX project, contract in full, effective immediately. And like that nail in my tire that kept me in New Orleans for an extra day, we buried the lead. So sorry. While South Carolina made it through another election year with minimal speed bumps, there are some issues that need to be addressed, specifically new voter machines. While the state's 13,000 current voter machines didn't prevent a record 1.7 million South Carolinians from voting on November 6th, they did contribute to long lines and delays in some precincts. We also look at some of the new faces coming to the Statehouse next year, the future of the ballot referendum voters shot down that would have made the state superintendent of education appointed by the governor rather than elected, and some more tidbits of election night. Joining me to discuss all these issues is Shauna Adcox with the Post and Courier and South Carolina Public Radio's Russ McKinney. Welcome to you both.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Shauna, you just had an article recently about what House leaders want to see done with getting new voter machines out there by 2020, by the 2020 presidential election. What's the situation with that and what's kind of prompting them to act? It sounds like we have some more money that they can spend too.
Well, the machines we've got are 14 years old, and the technology in them, I think, is more like 20 years old. Mm-hmm. So they're obviously toward the end of their useful life. In fact, the Election Commission said that when they bought it, they knew it would have a 15-year lifespan. So they need new machines, and they've been asking the legislature for 6 years to just kind of set aside some money to stockpile for getting ready for this. And like normal, the legislature waits until the end. They've got about $5 million set aside, but mm-hmm. they need about $60 million now. And they do have a $177 million surplus left over from what wasn't spent or what wasn't needed at the end of the last fiscal year. And that's one-time money that Brian White says he'd like to put, you know, a good chunk of that toward new machines.
Seems like that would have been a good answer. And during some of those gubernatorial debates when they asked everyone, you know, what would you do with this extra money? Here's an easy one, like spend some more money on these voter machines.
Well, but Henry said you shouldn't spend it at all. So
that's right. He said you don't always need to spend money at once. And it seems like, you know, with that budget surplus, I mean, do you think this is going to be something that you think that might have bipartisan broad support for going forward?
I believe so. Judging from what Chairman White said, he's hearing from folks and from people that just responded to my article, honestly. Mm-hmm. You're not supposed to use, although they do a lot of times, you're not supposed to use one-time money for recurring expenses. So this would be a one-time project where they could, that seems to have bipartisan support for.
Mm-hmm. And you did that article looking at, you know, the elections. There was some talk about some precincts in Pickens County and Anderson County that had some issues with their voting machines, but it sounded like they were more human error forced. But what are some of the issues plaguing these machines? I mean, the batteries seem to be an issue. And
think about old technology, old computers. The batteries are going dead pretty quickly. Think about like an old iPhone. Your battery power gets less and less as it gets older.
And the calibration of the screens are
right.
off.
So that when it jostles, especially during transportation, basically if you hit the screen thinking you're going for one candidate, it might, if you don't quite hit it right, it might go for another candidate. Mm-hmm. Now, it'll tell you right away, so they have to recalibrate it. But obviously that does make voters go, whoa, what's up with these machines?
Mm-hmm. Also looking at, we're one of five states that use machines that don't have a paper trail. And these machines that they're looking at would be more secure in that sense, because that's something that security experts really want to see done on these voting machines.
Yeah, they definitely say the next one are going to have the paper trail so they can check it. They can audit it.
Russ, do you think there's pretty good support going forward for something like this? I mean, this is like just as basic as a bridge that needs to be fixed that's been slowly deteriorating.
And it certainly affects every member of the legislature because they all obviously have to run. If they can put that bipartisan support, like we're hearing may be coming, I think that's something that they may be able to address.
We know they don't like to do things that prohibit what they can do, but this is something that would inhibit them to get reelected.
Well, and think about what's happening in Florida right now. Our guys got to just look down there and go, oh, we don't want that in 2020. Mm-hmm. So,
switching to the statehouse, we did see some small changes on Election Day looking in the Senate particularly. There was no major big swings, obviously, the Senate. These senators weren't up for reelection this year, but there was that one special election for John Corson's seat here in Columbia that flipped Democrat, and that was for Dick Harpulian.
Which was a pretty big deal because Corson had held that seat for 34 years. So it's clearly been Republican for quite some time.
Mm-hmm. We look at the makeup of the Senate now. It's 27 Republicans, 19 Democrats.
You know, in the Senate, one senator can block things, mm-hmm. and one senator can get up there and filibuster. And, well, they don't call it a filibuster, but it's a filibuster. And it will be interesting to see what Harpootlian does. He will, I'm sure, make things entertaining.
What do you say that for?
Well, he's known for his big personality, to put it mildly. And so he's known for just speaking his mind as mm-hmm. well. So it'll be fun.
Well, and Russ, looking at his background, I mean, he's had a lot of positions, former state Democratic Party chairman among them. I mean, what does that bring? I mean, we saw some interesting advertising. We saw some back and forth. It was a pretty close race. What was it, 52-48? Mm-hmm. He won against Benjamin Dunn. So something that people always kind of knew this district was going to be going for Democrat possibly. And I think he was probably the one that would really help move that needle. Obviously, he did because he has that outside personality. He does have that name recognition. And what does that mean when we look at what's going to happen in the Senate now?
Well, as Sean indicated, Dick's not a bashful guy, and he's pretty good on his feet. He's a former member of Richland County Council. He was a circuit solicitor for the Fifth Circuit for Richland and Kershaw counties, and as you mentioned, state Democratic Party chairman. So I think he'll certainly make it interesting at times.
Mm-hmm. And then looking at the House, it was a draw in the House of Representatives where there's 124 elected officials. We saw two seats go to Republicans and Democrats also flip two seats. So no major surprises there. I don't really need to list off all of those. But Shauna, again, no supermajority in the House at this point.
One of the seats that the Republicans picked up was merely because Mike Anthony retired and no Democrat bothered to run.
And that was something that Republicans told me on election night was kind of like, you know, the Democrats did make a big push in March to get a lot of people to file to register, but then there was this one that just didn't even, no one even registered to file for it.
I guess they, you know, the assumption was in that district, Mike Anthony held that seat because he'd been there for so long, but it was probably going to flip to Republican.
Mm-hmm. And then we did see some movement down in, with the Lowcountry. We saw, and I think a lot of people were saying in the Lowcountry, we saw some of that flip towards Democrats because of some of the ripple effects of the first congressional district. Is that something you guys
probably
saw in reporting?
Yeah. Although there was the one seat, Patsy Knight's seat, that was in the Lowcountry that flipped to Republican.
And that was one that the Republicans were always kind of keeping an eye on. Russ, what do you think about this? I mean, are we going to see, obviously there's no changes. There's still, 80 Republicans and 44 Democrats in the State House. And I think supermajority is 83, essentially.
I think so.
I had to Google what's two-thirds of 124, and it said 82.6, so we ran up to 83. But what happens, I mean, they always have to work together, and even, you know, members of the own Republican Party sometimes don't align with what they want to do for these situations. When they have to overturn a veto, for example, or, you know, the state superintendent of education bill that had to get on the ballot needed two-thirds since it was a constitutional amendment. Are we going to see any changes from the House in the way they act?
I don't think you'll see any real changes there. That's the Republican majority in the House is a strong, solid majority. And in the House, unlike the Senate, majority rules. And the Republican leadership's pretty good, pretty solid about deciding what the game plan is. And they have the numbers. So I don't think you'll see too much of a change in the House.
And then kind of just talking about one of the biggest surprises we did see on election night was the superintendent of education referendum. Shauna, you wrote about this. We're one of 13 states that elects their superintendent of education. And we did have that ballot referendum trying to get the governor to appoint the superintendent of education. That failed 60-40 on Tuesday. So what are you hearing? And
got a pretty good shellacking.
Yeah. I mean, do you think a lot of people took it for granted that they just thought that was going to maybe go through because we have a history of these ballot referendums just kind of going through, and, you know, the adjutant general obviously is different than the superintendent of education.
Well, the lieutenant governor's change, that went through pretty easily.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'll be honest, I initially thought it would go through easily just like those would, because they fought for so long to put that thing on there. For 15 years they wanted that thing on there. And then no one advocated for it. I mean, it was just kind of, I think even the people that wanted it to happen just kind of assumed, you know, it would go through, no big deal. And mm-hmm. then suddenly everyone, the polls, I guess, were showing it was going to get walloped. And everyone kind of freaked out. And the state chamber of commerce did that last minute push.
Yeah, because you saw support from superintendents of it, previous superintendents, the current, other governors. I mean, from across the political spectrum.
Yeah, it was kind of interesting. I mean, it was a priority of the Republican leadership in the legislature and by Governor McMaster to get this thing passed. And as you recall, we stood right outside the Senate door in the final seconds of this year's session.
Yeah.
They were able to push it through. It was a big win. They were excited about it. And then
people were hugging each other.
Yeah. And as Shauna says, it's kind of like the air went out of it, and you didn't hear anything about it again until a couple of weeks before the election.
Yeah.
I mean, we did have some time. We've had a week now since we're cutting this on Wednesday to do a little bit more post-mortem. So it was really the messaging that didn't come across. I mean, I would have thought that, you know, if there's a bunch of people that are for this, you know, within the legislature that, you know, they're out campaigning, that you would think that they'd be saying that first thing, even these statewide elected officials and the governor, for example. Obviously, James Smith was not so crazy about it because there wasn't enough of an education requirement, which is why I think a lot of teachers specifically voted against giving the governor this power.
Well, the legislation that kind of accompanied the bill that put it on the ballot that sets up the qualifications had the voters said yes. It didn't require any educational experience. It gave an or. You could either have education experience or you could have business experience, which a lot of the educators were not so thrilled about.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I talked to the president of the SCEA, Education Association, and she said, really, for her members, it was by and large the fact they wanted to keep electing the state's top educator.
Hmm. And just because that gives them more of a check on their own? Or, what I mean, Russ, you've seen this debate play out over the years.
Yeah, I talked to a public school teacher who didn't know anything about this, didn't realize the question was even going to be there. She read it and said, no way. And I think where she said she came from is it just struck her as something that's taking more of the public out of public education, whether that really, you know, is out there or not. But when you look at strong advocates of public education, they believe in the public being involved, PTAs, parents, volunteer groups, that kind of thing. So perhaps maybe some people read that into it, that it was kind of, you know, turning it more into a political decision than removing it from teachers and others, education advocates.
So we don't think it has anything to do with maybe giving the executive branch in South Carolina more power because we are such a, you know, the governor's so powerless in so many respects.
I don't think voters really thought that far.
Yeah. But do you think that that is something that, I mean, that would have been a pretty big jump for the executive branch in South Carolina to have that ability to, you know, not only talk about education but help actually implement their priorities by having the superintendent in-house, essentially?
Well, and then the part of the argument for it, the thought that this might force the governor to take more of a stand, take more of a bully pulpit for education and education reform. Now, whether that would actually happen, who knows?
Mm-hmm. We did see Superintendent of Education Molly Spearman elected to a second term fairly
easily
because she didn't have the Democrat that was challenging her dropped out for several reasons. Obviously, one of them was felony conviction in the past, but he also said that he was dropping out for health reasons, I guess.
Well, and another argument for the appointment thing was it wouldn't require the education superintendent to spend so much time campaigning every four years. But this time, that wasn't an issue anyway.
Mm-hmm.
She had a write-in candidate, but obviously write-in candidates have slim to no chance anyway.
So we gearing up for State House right now? You excited? January's coming?
Well, my gosh, there's meetings all week this week. It's kind of, there's no off session really anymore. It's kind of annoying.
What do you think, Ross? Are you ready for it to come January?
Well, Sean is right. They meet year round now. I mean, rarely a week goes by between adjournment and January when there's one or two committee meetings. Mm-hmm. Like, I think there are two today as we're recording this.
Mm-hmm. So, again, a lot of issues and a lot of reasons back and forth about extending or shortening session, but that's a topic for another podcast. Shauna Adcox with the Post and Courier and Russ McKinney with South Carolina Public Radio. Guys, thanks for joining me this week.
Thank you.
Thanks.
If you thought the campaign trail ended last Tuesday, then you're flat wrong. We're going to be watching out for a lot of 2020 traffic and other campaigns as they pop up. So stay tuned out there, you campaign trailheads. Congressman-elect Joe Cunningham, who had one of the biggest upsets nationwide by defeating Katie Arrington for the 1st Congressional District, hasn't even been sworn in yet. However, there is already a poll looking at future Republican challengers against him. And if you think that's rude, don't worry, because 42% of GOP-leaning voters said Cunningham deserves a chance before they find a challenger. That's according to this poll. Remember that this district hadn't gone to a Democrat in more than 30 years. The Post and Courier reports that Katie Arrington leads that pack, his challenger, at 32%, with Mark Sanford, whom she defeated in June for the nomination, is at 26%. There's a lot more down in the single digits, with Tom Davis, the state senator from Beaufort, coming in a distant third. That poll was conducted by South Carolina-based Ivory Tusk Consulting and Florida-based Political Marketing International. There's a 2% margin of error. Also inside the South Carolina congressional delegation, Congressman-elect William Timmons' Election Day win in the 4th Congressional District has caused a special election to be called to fill his state Senate District 6 seat representing Greenville County. Now, March 26th will be the special election date, and two candidates have already announced their intention to run once filing opens at the end of the month. State Representative Dwight Loftus and Greenville City Councilwoman Amy Ryberg Doyle have announced their candidacies for the state Senate earlier this week. And a correction we want to add to last week's mini-pod. We mistakenly mentioned that Pamela Evatt became the state's first female lieutenant governor. She does become the state's first Republican female lieutenant governor, but Nancy Stephenson was the first female lieutenant governor of South Carolina in 1979. Rock on, Nancy. In our final section, Did You Know?, we focus on one quirky function of the state, politics, or government. It's named after the parliamentary procedure lawmakers use when speaking to each other. And like we just had Russ McKinney on for the major discussion, we have him back to give us some good trivia from the state. Russ, what do you got for me today? Is it going to be another easy one, I hope?
Well, of course. They're all easy. This Veterans Day got a lot of attention because it was 100th anniversary of the end of World War I. So there seemed to be a lot of little extra attention around Veterans Day this year, which is good. Mm-hmm. South Carolina, like most states, was affected by World War I. Some 65,000 people from the state were over there, as the song says, over there. The war also led to the creation of a number of military and military-related installations in South Carolina. Mm-hmm. So our question this week is, which of the following that were related or came about during World War I, no longer around today, no longer active today?
All right.
Easy.
Easy. Okay. Easy.
A, Camp Jackson. B, Paris Island Marine Corps Recruit Depot. C, the Yemassee Train Depot. D, Charleston Naval Base.
Not around anymore, as in not functioning what it originally was.
I mean, are existing, correct.
I mean, Camp Jackson, we're going to go ahead and say it's Fort Jackson. I mean, that's like some
I'll concede that.
Okay, I'm not going to be like, oh, well, it doesn't exist anymore. Like,
Paris Island Marine Corps Recruit Depot, the Yemassee Train Depot, and the Charleston Naval Base.
I know they've redone the Charleston Naval Base for other purposes. I don't know if it's actually like the way the naval base used to be. So, I mean, we're splitting hairs again. I'm going to go with that.
Going to go with Charleston Naval Base?
Yeah.
You are correct.
Ooh!
The Charleston Naval Base does not
exist. Was it close?
Does not exist. Now, they are still Navy-related activities in and around Charleston. But the naval base is no longer there, where there were surface and submarine squadrons for years were home-ported at Charleston. The naval base is now no longer exist.
What's the Yemassee train station?
Well, now that's interesting. The Yemassee train depot is in the small town of Yemassee. And that is where, for years, recruits on their way in and out of Paris Island would come and get off the train in Yemassee. It's a small town. The county line of Beaufort and Hampton County actually dissects the town of Yemassee. The Amtrak train service between Miami and New York still stops there. Both ways. Yemassee also is very near the Jasper and Carlton County lines, and it is considered the geographic center of the Lowcountry.
Wow. Okay, we just got a lot more right there. I feel like we could have done the... You could have asked me the geographic center.
What is the geographic center of the
Lowcountry? That's like a twofer right there, yeah. You guys can take that one home and use it on your friends. Thanks, Russ.
You're welcome.
The South Carolina Lead is one of many ways SCETV wants to help keep you informed. Check out the latest news and live streams on SCETV.org. Listen to coverage from South Carolina Public Radio and watch This Week in South Carolina, a show where I talk with the newsmakers of the week on SCETV Friday at 7:30 p.m. and Sunday at 11:30 a.m. All of that, this podcast, and more is available on SCETV's super easy-to-use app and scpublicradio.org. Subscribe to us, and we'll have a new episode for you every Tuesday on Apple Podcasts. Search us easily on your Android, the NPR One app, or wherever you find podcasts. Follow us on Instagram at @scleadpod, where you can see photos from the studio, on assignment, and of course, our dank memes. We're also on Twitter with the same handle, at @scleadpod. We have swag, sticker swag that is, so send us a direct message on Twitter or slide into our Instagram DMs with your address, and we'll send one your way. Email questions, comments, or your gripes to scled@scetv.org. The South Carolina Lead is produced in partnership with South Carolina ETV, South Carolina Public Radio, and a special thanks to the Post and Courier. Our producer is A.T. Shire. Sean Birch is our supervising producer. Kaylin Park is our social media strategist. Tom Posey is our executive producer. This episode was recorded and produced in South Carolina Public Radio's studios here in Columbia on November 13th, 2018. I'm Gavin Jackson. Thanks for listening. Secret message. Wash your hands before it's too late.